Imagine you were staring at a system, like maybe it's a massive government bureaucracy or a huge multinational corporation.
Or honestly, even just, a really toxic workplace you've been stuck in at some point.
Yeah, exactly. We have all been there. So you are standing there, right? And you are watching this system just churn along. And it is perfectly
Oh
organized.
yeah, the spreadsheets are pristine.
Right, the spreadsheets are updated, the meetings are scheduled, the press releases go out exactly on time. But simultaneously, this exact same system is producing like very obvious, very undeniable damage to the people inside it, or the community around it.
Apparently.
And you look at the leaders and you look at the middle managers and you just wonder, how do they not see it?
It's wild.
It is. How can a system be so intelligent, so capable of predicting its quarterly earnings or managing this ridiculously complex global supply chain, and yet be completely, utterly blind to the suffering it causes on a daily basis?
It is a universally maddening experience. I mean, you find yourself waving this massive red flag, pointing directly at the damage.
Just screaming, "Look at this!"
Exactly. Assuming that if you just show them the data, they will fix it. But the system absorbs your red flag, files it in some drawer labeled feedback, and just continues operating exactly as it did before.
Yep, it's like you're talking to a brick wall.
Because the core assumption we make is that the system actually wants to know the truth.
And today, our mission on this deep dive is to unpack why that assumption is fundamentally flawed. We are diving into an incredibly dense, transdisciplinary white paper published in July 2026 by Dr. Bechara Saley.
It is an absolute beast of a paper.
It really is. I read this document a few times, and it's a masterclass in synthesis. It's titled "Letting the Wound Update the Model."
Great title.
Really good. And Dr. Saley, he pulls from neuroscience, evolutionary biology, political theory, international law, all of it, to explain what he calls the architecture of denial.
Which is such a powerful phrase.
It is. His goal is to map out exactly why systems ignore suffering, like the specific invisible mechanisms they use to defend themselves from the truth, and how we might physically redesign our institutions so they actually learn from their mistakes before it's too late.
The ambition of this paper is just staggering. Because, we usually analyze toxic bureaucracies or geopolitical conflicts through this lens of pure politics or economics.
Right, like who has the money or the votes?
Exactly. But Dr. Saikali takes a totally different route. He argues that to understand institutional denial, we actually have to understand the fundamental biological mechanisms of human cognition.
Wow.
Yeah, he builds a bridge from the behavior of single cells all the way up to the behavior of the United Nations.
That is quite the leap. But before we jump into those nuts and bolts, we really need to set the table here because this paper does not shy away from the real world.
No, it definitely does not.
Dr. Saley stress tests his theory by applying it to some deeply entrenched geopolitical conflicts, structural violence, and honestly, some of the most politically charged crises happening on the globe right now.
Very sensitive stuff.
Super sensitive. So, because these topics are so heavily debated, let's be very, very clear about our role today. Our goal is not to endorse the author's viewpoints. We aren't here to pick political sides, and we aren't here to pass moral judgment on the actors involved in these case studies.
Right.
We are strictly here to serve as impartial guides to the text itself. We are going to neutrally unpack his exact theoretical frameworks and look strictly at how he applies his concepts to these institutions. The objective is for you, the listener, to just understand the machinery of his argument.
Yeah, we are essentially examining a new analytical lens. So we will put those glasses on, look at the world through them to see how Dr. Saley interprets systemic behavior under stress, and then we will take them off.
Exactly. It is an exercise in structural analysis, not a political verdict.
Well said.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with the hard science, because this is really the foundation of the entire architecture. The author roots his political theory in biology, specifically something called the free energy principle.
Right.
Now, I have heard this term tossed around in like artificial intelligence circles, but how does it apply to living systems?
So the free energy principle is primarily driven by Karl Friston, who is this wildly influential neuroscientist. And Friston was trying to solve a very basic but incredibly difficult puzzle,
Okay.
which is how do living systems manage to exist at all?
That is a pretty big puzzle.
Yeah, just a small question about the nature of life. Because, the universe is governed by entropy. Everything trends toward disorder. A cup of hot coffee cools down and dissipates its heat. A sandcastle eventually crumbles into the beach. Things fall apart.
Right.
Yet living things, from a tiny single-celled amoeba to a human being, they manage to maintain their boundaries and their internal structure in a world that is constantly changing and totally unpredictable.
So if entropy is the rule, life is this bizarre exception, like we actively resist falling apart.
Exactly. Friston's theory proposes that living systems resist entropy by minimizing uncertainty, which he mathematically defines as free energy.
Okay, so free energy basically means uncertainty.
Yes. But organisms don't just sit there passively, you know, hoping the environment doesn't destroy them. They engage in a continuous process called active inference.
Active inference. Got it.
Right. Living things maintain what is called a generative model of reality. This is essentially an internal probabilistic map. The organism has a map of what kind of world it lives in, what kind of creature it is, and what states of being are necessary for its survival.
So I want to make sure I am really grasping this generative model concept. Are we talking about conscious thought? Like, I have a model of my morning commute in my head.
I mean, it includes that, sure.
Yeah.
But it goes much, much deeper, all the way down to the unconscious and biological levels.
Like what?
Like, your body has a generative model that your core temperature should be roughly 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. It expects that state. And this brings us to the absolute linchpin of Dr. Saihely's paper, which is the concept of self-evidencing.
Self-evidencing?
Yes. A living system survives by constantly self-evidencing.
Okay, self-evidencing. That sounds like a lawyer trying to describe an airtight alibi or something. But in biology, what does it mean to be evidence of yourself?
Well, we usually think of evidence as this objective search for the truth, right? Like a scientist gathers evidence to see if their hypothesis is wrong.
Right, trying to prove themselves wrong to find the real answer.
Exactly. But Fristonian self-evidencing is the complete opposite. A living system perceives the world and acts on the world in ways that maximize evidence for its own continued existence.
Wow.
It constantly seeks sensory data that proves its internal generative model is correct.
Wait, hold on. If a system is just seeking evidence to prove its existing map of the world is right, isn't that just a fancy biological term for confirmation bias?
Ah, that is a brilliant connection. And you are hitting on the exact vulnerability that the paper explores later.
Okay.
But on a basic biological survival level, it is a highly adaptive feature. Under active inference, an organism reduces the gap between its expectations and reality in two intertwined ways.
And what are those?
First, it can update its beliefs. It changes its internal model to fit the sensory evidence coming from the world. Like, you step outside, a gust of wind hits you, and you update your model. Ah, it is colder than I thought.
Right. That part seems really straightforward. That is just basic learning. You touch a hot stove, you update your model that stoves burn you.
Exactly. But the second way is where the magic really happens. The organism doesn't just update its beliefs. It acts on the world to change the sensory evidence so that it fits the internal model.
Oh, interesting.
Let's go back to the temperature example. A cold organism doesn't just passively update its model to say, oh, well, I guess I am freezing to death.
Right, because that would be the end of the organism.
Yeah, that would violate its deepest generative model of being a living, warm creature.
Mm-hmm.
So it shivers. It puts on a coat. It builds a fire. It physically alters its environment or its relationship to the environment to generate the specific sensory data that proves its model is correct.
So it generates evidence of its own warmth.
Yes. I am warm. I am alive.
Okay, I think I have an analogy for this. It sounds exactly like a thermostat on a wall.
Yes.
Because, like, a thermometer just passively reads the temperature. It updates its belief about the room, right? But a thermostat has a model of the room. If the model says the room should be 70 degrees and the sensor reads 65, the thermostat doesn't just accept the new data.
It fights back.
Right. It actively turns on the furnace to force the room to align with its expectations.
That is the classic analogy used in cybernetics and active inference. The thermostat self-evidences by triggering the furnace. An organism self-evidences by seeking food when its model expects a certain blood sugar level or running away from a predator when its model expects bodily integrity.
So perception and action are basically the same thing here.
Yes, they are not separate functions at all. They are a single continuous loop of self-maintenance. You are either updating the map to match the territory, or you are forcing the territory to match your map.
Man, that is fascinating. Okay, I track that on the level of a rabbit or, you know, a human body. But this is a paper about international relations and massive bureaucracies.
Right.
How do we scale a biological theory about minimizing uncertainty up to the level of the United Nations or a multinational corporation?
So Dr. Saihely pulls from recent extensions of active inference into collective behavior.
Yeah.
Researchers have begun applying these exact principles to human culture. Because humans don't just have biological models, we build massive, shared linguistic, social, and political models.
Okay, so we group together and form a bigger model.
Yes. We infer who we are, what constitutes a law, what defines a successful economy, who belongs to our group, and who is considered a threat.
So a corporation or state operates on a generative model just like an organism does.
Exactly. The paper refers to these shared models as regimes of expectation.
Regimes of expectation.
Yes. A regime of expectation is a socially stabilized field of meaning. Think about walking into a courtroom. It is a highly structured regime of expectation. You intuitively know the script.
Yeah, you walk in and you automatically whisper.
Exactly. You expect a judge to be seated higher up. You expect a specific vocabulary to be used. And you know what kinds of behaviors will be immediately punished. These shared expectations exert an enormous directive force on reality.
They shape what's even possible in that room.
They literally dictate what is possible to perceive and what is impossible to articulate within that space.
That makes total sense. But who decides what fits the model? Like, if society is one big collective brain trying to self-evidence, who acts as the sensory organs?
The paper points to what he calls epistemic communities.
Okay.
These are groups like a guild of medical professionals, a judicial system, or a network of legacy media newsrooms that serve as the organs of collective perception.
They are the eyes and ears.
Exactly. They decide what counts as valid knowledge. They determine whose testimony is considered credible, actionable evidence, and whose testimony is dismissed as just, you know, anecdotal noise.
I want to pause here for a second because this framework makes a lot of sense. But if a society or an institution is successfully predicting its environment, maintaining its boundaries, and reducing uncertainty for its members, isn't that a resounding success?
That's the logical conclusion, right?
Yeah, that is literally the definition of surviving. Why does the paper frame this as a potential catastrophe?
And that question drops us right into what Dr. Soley calls the normative gap.
The normative gap.
Yes. The free energy principle is a phenomenal explanatory tool. It explains the mechanics of how systems survive and maintain their structure. But it is ethically empty.
Has no morals.
None. It does not possess a moral compass.
Yeah.
It cannot tell us if the thing that is being conserved is actually good, healthy, or life-serving.
Because survival itself isn't inherently moral. Like a parasite survives.
Exactly. Consider a cancer cell. A cancer cell is incredibly effective at self-organizing. It minimizes its own free energy. It creates its own blood supply networks.
It's doing great at surviving.
It is phenomenally successful at self-evidencing and forcing the local environment to match its generative model right up until the moment it gets a host body and destroys itself.
Oh, wow. So biological success does not equal ecological success.
That's precisely. And you can scale that up to social systems.
Yeah.
A deeply entrenched colonial order self-organizes. A massive state-sponsored propaganda machine minimizes uncertainty for the ruling class.
Yeah.
A global financial market that actively destroys the ecological biosphere that sustains it is technically self-evidencing.
Wow. Yeah. They are all successfully defending their preferred boundaries.
Right.
They are viable, but they are deeply toxic. They are cancer cells.
To bridge this gap between mere survival and actual health, Dr. Sighelli brings in the work of philosopher John McMurtry, specifically his life value philosophy. Sighelli introduces a critical threshold called life coherence. A system self-evidencing is only life coherent when its self-maintenance actively protects, restores, or enlarges the life capacity of the wider field in which it depends.
Life capacity. Okay, that sounds a bit abstract to me. How do we measure that in the real world?
McMurtry defines it in intensely material and relational terms. Life capacity is not abstract GDP growth or corporate profit margins.
It's not just a number on a chart.
No. It is the real, tangible ability of living beings to breathe clean air, to eat nourishing food, to learn, to heal from illness, to move freely, to participate in their communities, and to live with dignity within ecological boundaries that aren't collapsing.
Okay, that is very grounded.
Yes, it is the actual physical capacity for biological and social flourishing.
So if an institution preserves its own internal order by destroying the life capacity of the environment or the people outside its walls, it has crossed the line from survival into pathology. And this brings us to the central diagnosis of the paper, which is pathological self-evidencing. I found this concept so chilling.
It's very dark.
Because this isn't a broken system. It's a system that is working perfectly to protect its identity, but it achieves that by actively suppressing, discounting, or destroying the evidence of the harm it causes.
Right.
And the paper refers to this suppressed harm as life evidence.
Yes. A pathological system asks reality to protect its model, rather than allowing its model to answer to reality.
Yeah.
It desperately wants to keep feeling true, so it eliminates the facts that make it feel false.
Let's ground this in a scenario just to make sure we've got it. Say you have a government agency responsible for housing.
Okay.
Their internal generative model says, we are highly efficient managers. Okay. The paperwork is impeccable. The budgets are perfectly balanced. The internal audits are glowing.
Everything looks great on paper.
Right. But outside the building, their policies are causing massive spikes in homelessness. People are literally sleeping on the steps of the agency. Does the bureaucracy look at the people on the steps and think, wow, we are failing? Or does the pathology meme, they look at the balanced budget and think, we are doing a phenomenal job?
What's fascinating here is how the paper explains this cognitive dissonance. It uses a mechanism called precision weighting.
Precision weighting?
Yes. In active inference, the brain, or the institution, does not treat all sensory signals equally, because we would be completely overwhelmed if we paid equal attention to everything.
Right, sensory overload.
So the system weights signals based on how reliable or important it expects them to be. A high-precision signal acts like an alarm bell. It forces the system to stop what it's doing and update its model immediately.
Okay.
A low-precision signal is treated as background static. It doesn't trigger model update at all.
Oh, man. You see the same dynamic in corporate HR departments all the time, right?
Well, absolutely.
Like, if the CEO sends an email complaining about the coffee in the break room, that is a high-precision signal. Action is taken away in 5 minutes. The coffee is replaced.
Instantly.
Right. But if 50 lower-level employees complain that the warehouse conditions are causing chronic back injuries, it's deemed anecdotal or needs further study.
Exactly.
It's low precision. The back injuries are just background static to the system.
That is an excellent application of the concept. In political and social systems, power dictates precision. Dr. Sefilisliz argues that if a global stock market dips by 2%, institutional systems treat that as a five-alarm fire. High precision.
Oh, yeah. It's headline news.
The model updates instantly. Emergency meetings are called by central banks. Liquidity is injected into the markets. The system responds to protect its core model of economic growth.
Huh.
But if a marginalized community reports that their drinking water is contaminated with lead, the system treats that as low precision.
It's a localized issue.
Exactly. It is framed as complex, unverifiable, or an isolated incident.
The system protects its coherence by literally muting the alarms of actual human suffering. The suffering is there, the data is there, but the system's immune response neutralizes it before it can force a change in behavior.
That is exactly what happens.
This transitions us beautifully into the how. How do these massive systems actually mute those alarms in practice? The paper lays out a whole playbook. It identifies 10 specific mechanisms of pathological self-evidencing.
Yes, and reading through these is like seeing the underlying source code of political denial.
Let's walk through how they function.
We can group these logically, starting with how a system manipulates empathy. The first mechanism is precision distortion, which relies heavily on selective empathy.
Selective empathy.
A system amplifies the pain and humanity of those who reside inside its preferred moral circle. When those insiders suffer, the suffering is rendered vividly. It has a name, a face, a history. It demands urgent, massive intervention.
Right, it's very visceral.
But the suffering of those outside the moral frame is structurally dimmed. It becomes distant, abstract, statistical, or even framed as an unfortunate but strategically necessary byproduct of order.
Wow.
If the system were forced to feel the suffering of the outsider with the exact same precision it feels the suffering of the insider, its internal model of its own inherent goodness would collapse.
That makes perfect sense. You have to emotionally distance yourself from the people you are harming, or your own conscience becomes a threat to your stability.
Precisely.
And that leads right into how a system justifies the harm it causes, which the paper calls narrative capture.
Mm.
And the example he gives here regarding border militarization is incredibly dark.
It is a profound example.
Imagine a state's generative model asserts that migration is a fundamental security threat. Because the system believes this, it heavily militarizes the most common, safest border crossings.
And what is the immediate material result of that action?
It forces migrants who are already fleeing desperate circumstances to take much more dangerous, deadly routes. They have to cross treacherous deserts or navigate rough seas in flimsy boats. Consequently, the death toll spikes. Chaos and desperation increase at these new remote flashpoints.
Right.
Now, a healthy system would look at that death toll and say, our policy is causing a humanitarian disaster. We need to change our model.
But the pathological system engages in narrative capture. It looks at the chaos, the desperation, and the sheer volume of deaths, and it points to those very things as absolute proof that the border is indeed under severe attack.
That is twisted.
It uses the danger it just manufactured to justify the necessity of its initial militarization, and usually demands even more funding for more weapons. The model creates a crisis, and then consumes the crisis as evidence of its own indispensable necessity. It is a completely self-sealing inferential loop.
But how do the people operating the system, like the border guards, the politicians, how do they look at a dying person and not feel that life evidence?
Because of the next mechanism, which is role assignment before encounter.
Role assignment.
Before the human being even have a chance to speak, the system has already assigned them an administrative category that neutralizes their testimony. The living subject is flattened into an object.
The power of language right there.
Yes. The desperate person seeking asylum becomes an illegal entrant. The civilian trapped in a bombing zone is preemptively defined as a human shield. The local resident protesting contaminated water is categorized as an outside agitator.
Right. You strip away their humanity before you even interact with them.
Exactly. Once that role is assigned, the people inside the system no longer have to engage with the complex life evidence of a fellow human being. They only have to interact with the label. And you don't have to empathize with the label.
Let me push back on something, though. Sometimes the harm isn't just a byproduct of a policy. Sometimes the system is actively exporting its chaos to someone else to maintain its instability. Like, it's intentional.
Yes, and you are describing the conservation of innocence and the externalization of uncertainty.
Okay, that sounds heavy.
It is. This is how wealthy, powerful institutions stabilize their models. They reduce their own internal free energy by increasing the entropy of marginalized populations.
So they dump their chaos on someone else.
Exactly. Consider a wealthy nation attempting to stabilize its energy grid and project a model of a green transition and ecological innocence. To achieve this, it might rely on the massive extraction of critical minerals from the global south.
So the wealthy nation gets the electric vehicles, the clean air, and the feeling of moral progress. They feel innocent.
And it achieves that by externalizing the immense ecological devastation, the poison watersheds, and the exploitative labor conditions to an extraction zone halfway across the world. The wealthy nation conserves its generative model of innocence, while the marginalized region absorbs all the biological and social risk.
Wow.
The powerful system keeps its own world highly predictable by making the other's world completely unpredictable and hazardous.
But surely the people at the top of these systems know what's happening. They read the reports, they have the data on the extraction zones or the border deaths. Do they just sit in a room and agree to be evil?
Rarely. And that is why the concept of institutional anesthesia is so crucial.
Anesthesia, like numbing the pain?
Yes. This mechanism explains how people inside the system can conceptually know the truth without feeling compelled to act on it. Bureaucracies are brilliant at this.
How does that work?
Well, the data is gathered. A comprehensive report on the ecological damage is commissioned. A committee reviews the findings. The concern is officially noted in the meeting minutes.
So everyone knows it's happening.
But the institutional setting itself, the sterile boardroom, the rigid agenda, the compartmentalization of departments, it trains the individuals not to feel the moral weight of the data. The mandate of the committee is limited, so they pass it to another department. Meeting adjourns. The individuals go to lunch.
They just compartmentalize it away.
The people possess the knowledge, but the system is anesthetized against action.
And if they are absolutely forced to take action by public pressure, they engage in my favorite distinction in the entire paper, which is the conversion of repair into management.
Oh, this is a brilliant one.
I really want to spend a minute on this because it's profound. Management stabilizes a symptom so the system can keep running. Repair actually changes the underlying relationships that caused the wound in the first place.
What analogy comes to mind for you here?
It's the leaky roof. Imagine your house has a massive hole in the roof, and every time it rains, water pours into the living room, ruining the floor.
Okay.
Management is putting a bucket under the leak. And a really sophisticated system will set up a whole department of bucket management. They will track how much water is collected each hour. They will generate beautiful, full-color quarterly reports on bucket efficiency. And they will call themselves highly successful plumbers.
All while the floor rots.
Right. Because if you ask them to climb a ladder and actually patch the hole in the roof, they will tell you that is outside their scope of practice.
That is a perfect analogy.
And the paper gives a brutal real-world example. providing trauma counseling to marginalized communities, while deliberately keeping those communities in the exact political or economic conditions that are traumatizing them.
Yes.
You manage the psychological symptoms so you don't have to repair the systemic disease.
It is the illusion of action. Mm-hmm. And when people demand actual repair, the system deploys temporal deferral.
Deferring it into the future.
The harm is finally admitted, but the correction is endlessly pushed off. We agree this is an issue, but now is not the time for radical change. We need a 5-year study. We must wait for the next election cycle.
Kick the can down the road.
It moves the moment of accountability permanently beyond the horizon.
And what happens when someone refuses to wait? What happens when an employee or a citizen refuses the anesthesia, rejects the management, and demands repair now?
The system triggers its final defense, which is enemy production. When the disconfirming evidence simply will not go away, the system attacks the messenger. The whistleblower is no longer an employee trying to save the company. They are a disgruntled, toxic traitor.
They become the problem.
The investigative journalist is smeared as a partisan propagandist. The system must destroy the witness, because the witness is a living, breathing threat to the generative model.
It's a flawless psychological defense mechanism just scaled up to the size of a state. It shows us that denial isn't simply a PR strategy or a series of lies. It's an inferential architecture. It is how reality itself is organized by power.
Exactly.
But, you know, theory is only as good as its application. And this is where Dr. Sahili really stress tests his framework, taking us into the messy, highly contested reality of global geopolitics.
And again, as we shift into these geopolitical case studies, we must maintain strict analytical discipline here. The author explicitly states he is not equating these diverse crises, nor is he attempting to rank human suffering.
Right. It's not a competition.
No. He is utilizing them as revealing cases. He wants to demonstrate how wildly different systems all utilize the exact same underlying biological mechanisms to protect their preferred models by lowering the precision of life evidence.
Right. We are walking through the author's applications neutrally. We are looking at the mechanics. Let's start with the first grouping of cases, which revolves around sovereignty and the constraint of small nations, specifically focusing on the Caribbean.
The first application is Cuba. The author frames the situation in Cuba as a massive, tragic, inferential trap created by two competing self-evidencing systems locked in a decades-long struggle.
So on one side of the trap, you have the United States. Okay. According to the paper's framework, the U.S. maintains a geopolitical generative model that views socialist governance as inherently flawed and bound for collapse.
Yes.
When there is economic deprivation, crumbling infrastructure, or civilian protests in Cuba, the U.S. model absolves this as high-precision evidence that its core theory is correct. Socialism is failing. This model is then used to justify the continuation of severe, decades-long economic sanctions. The sanctions aren't framed by the system as a deliberate deprivation of life support. They are framed as a necessary moral pressure applied to force democratic correction.
Exactly. The model requires the suffering to validate its premise. But on the other side of the trap, the Cuban state conserves its own generative model.
Which is what?
A revolutionary model built on sovereignty, endurance, and resistance against an imperial siege. Within this state model, economic scarcity is not viewed as a failure of domestic policy. It is interpreted as high-precision evidence of external aggression.
Oh, I see.
Therefore, when citizens protest the lack of food or electricity, the state's model downweights the internal origin of those grievances. The dissent is interpreted as externally induced or manipulated, which then justifies extreme internal vigilance, the narrowing of civic space, and defensive entrenchment.
It is a devastating trap. Both systems are perfectly self-evidencing. They both absorb the actual lived suffering of ordinary Cuban citizens, the rolling blackouts, the lack of medical supplies, the sheer exhaustion of daily survival as evidence for their own models.
It's cyclical.
The suffering fuels both the U.S. sanctions and the Cuban state's internal security apparatus. The author points out that a life-coherent correction would require a mutual shattering of these models.
Yes.
It would demand an end to the external economic strangulation by the U.S., paired simultaneously with profound internal opening, participatory repair, and transparent governance from the Cuban state. Neither side wants to update its model, so the people bear the cost.
The second case in this Caribbean cluster examines the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States, the OECS, and their citizenship by investment programs, which are commonly known globally as golden passports.
I found this analysis incredibly insightful because it exposes a deep hypocrisy in how the global order assigns precision. Well, powerful, wealthier nations in the global north. Look at these Caribbean nations selling citizenship, and they see a glaring security vulnerability. The global north is conserving a model of strict, heavily regulated border control. To them, the idea that someone can just buy a passport bypasses their entire security apparatus. So they apply intense pressure on the Caribbean to shut these programs down.
But the author pivots the lens to ask, what is the life evidence of the Caribbean nations?
Right.
These are small island developing states. They are on the absolute front lines of a climate crisis they did not historically create. They are facing intensified hurricanes and coastal erosion. Simultaneously, the global financial system denies them adequate non-punitive climate finance. They are structurally constrained.
They have no options.
Therefore, from the perspective of the islands, a citizenship by investment program isn't a luxury commodity. It is a desperate mechanism for fiscal survival. It is how they fund hurricane recovery, build resilient infrastructure, and keep their economies afloat.
The global system is literally forcing them to commodify their own sovereign identity just to survive the climate crisis the global system created.
Yes.
The powerful nations assign massive precision to their own border security anxieties, but they assign zero precision to the fiscal strangulation of the islands. The life-coherent solution the author proposes isn't to just capitulate and abolish the programs, which would financially ruin the islands.
No, it's a transformation of the model.
Right. He suggests tying the citizenship revenue directly and transparently to verifiable life capacity outcomes, like building renewable energy grids and ensuring water security, while aggressively demanding that the global order provide fair climate finance so the islands don't have to sell passports to survive in the first place.
It forces us to redefine sovereignty. Sovereignty isn't merely the ability to defend a border. It is the actual material capacity of a population to live and thrive.
Exactly.
This flows naturally into his next cluster of cases, which contrast security models directly against life capacity.
Let's examine the conflict in Sudan. How does the active inference framework apply to a civil war?
The author views the armed factions in Sudan as prime examples of pathological self-evidencing through the generation of chaos.
Generating chaos to survive.
Yes. These military factions create massive civilian insecurity, widespread displacement, and conditions of starvation. They destroy the civic infrastructure. And then, in a grim twist of logic, they use the very chaos and terror they have manufactured as proof to the international community that they're the only actors powerful enough to negotiate with.
Oh, that is so backwards.
The violence self-evidences their necessity as security guarantors. The suffering of the Sudanese people is treated as a regrettable but strategically necessary variable that does not force the factions to change their behavior.
But the paper doesn't just leave it at that bleak diagnosis. It highlights a life-coherent alternative that is emerging from the ground up, the emergency response rooms.
These are incredible. They are decentralized, grassroots, volunteer-led mutual aid networks operating in the neighborhoods where international aid agencies cannot or will not go.
And what makes them life-coherent?
Because their generative model is not based on dominating territory or proving military supremacy. They are organized entirely around raw life capacity, securing food, providing basic health care, and organizing civilian protection.
They are just tending to the wound.
They respond directly to the wound. They represent a form of political legitimacy built entirely from the emergency commons upward, completely bypassing the pathological security models of the warlords.
The author applies a similar analytical lens to Haiti. He argues that the international community often approaches Haiti through a highly constrained security frame, treating the nation almost exclusively as a gang problem that requires external policing to stabilize. This model heavily downweights the massive historical context of foreign intervention, forced debt extraction, and the dismantling of the Haitian agricultural economy. The security model seeks to manage the current chaos, but it is entirely unequipped to repair the deep civic and economic wounds.
It's management versus repair all over again.
Exactly. And then he brings up a historical case that perfectly illustrates the extreme end of the security pathology, the Chagos Archipelago.
The Chagos case is stark. For decades, the UK and the US have maintained a highly strategic military base on the island of Diego Garcia. The generative model of the Western security apparatus asserts that this base is an absolute, indispensable necessity for maintaining global order and protecting vital shipping lanes.
Okay, that's the model, but what's the wound?
The suppressed life evidence, the wound that was ignored to build the model, is that this security was achieved by forcibly rounding up and deporting the entire indigenous Chagossian population, abandoning them in poverty in Mauritius and the UK, and aggressively denying their right to return for over half a century.
The analysis here is just clear. A security model becomes fundamentally pathological when it defines its own optimal state of being as the permanent exile, dispossession, and erasure of another people. You cannot claim to be building global security if the foundation of your fortress is the destruction of a specific community.
You cannot.
And speaking of how we define security, this brings us to an analysis that I found absolutely devastating. Let's look at how the author applies precision distortion to Mediterranean migration policy. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Dr. Sali observes the generative models of European border management agencies. What do these systems consider success? They assign extremely high precision to a specific metric, the number of irregular arrivals on European shores.
They just want that number to go down.
The overarching goal of the system is to make that number go down. They also assign high precision to managing domestic political anxiety regarding migration.
So fewer boats landing equals policy success, but what is this system assigning low precision to? What is the ignored life evidence?
The death toll, the drownings in the Mediterranean, the disappearances in the desert, the thousands of people who were intercepted at sea and forcibly pushed back into detention centers with documented histories of severe abuse and torture.
It's horrifying.
The pathological model is simple. If the arrival numbers drop, order has been restored, and the agency receives its funding and political praise.
But the life evidence exposes a horrific reality. If you have achieved a drop in arrivals by deliberately destroying rescue capacities, criminalizing NGO ships, or paying warlords to intercept migrants before they reach the sea, you haven't solved the crisis. You have just moved the dying out of sight.
Yes.
The success metric itself is diseased. You have purchased the illusion of domestic order through the externalization of death. A life-coherent border model would evaluate itself first and foremost by the number of lives protected and the availability of safe legal pathways, not just by how effectively it can make desperate people disappear beyond the horizon.
This externalization of harm is a perfect bridge to his third cluster, which examines the green paradox and the architecture of climate finance. The author looks closely at the extraction of critical minerals, specifically in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo.
This is such a crucial point because it shows that even when a system is trying to do something morally necessary, like transitioning away from fossil fuels to stop climate change, it can still become pathological if it operates on a flawed generative model.
Right.
The Global North has constructed a model that says we are acting ethically because we are aggressively decarbonizing our economies and switching to electric vehicles.
But the life evidence demands that we ask, green for whom? Because if achieving that rapid decarbonization requires the massive expansion of cobalt and lithium mining in the DRC, and that mining relies on child labor, the poisoning of local watersheds, and horrific, dangerous working conditions, then the global green model is simply reproducing the exact same extractive colonial grammar it claims to be replacing.
The reduction in carbon emissions is granted high precision, but the shattered spine of a child miner in the DRC is granted low precision. The system congratulates itself for saving the planet while shifting the biological cost of that salvation onto the most vulnerable people on Earth.
It is entirely pathological. And the author finds a similar pathology in how the global financial system manages climate finance for small island developing states.
Oh, this part made me so angry.
It's tough to read. The dominant financial model conserves traditional market metrics, debt to GDP ratios, fiscal discipline, and sovereign credit ratings. So when a small island nation is physically devastated by a Category 5 hurricane, a hurricane whose intensity was fueled by the historical carbon emissions of industrialized nations, the financial system responds by offering them loans to rebuild.
It is a staggering injustice. The pathological model literally forces the victims of the climate crisis to borrow money from the very nations that caused the pollution in the first place, just to replace the hospitals and roads that the pollution destroyed. The model protects the sanctity of the debt contract over the survival of the island. A life-coherent model would recognize that demanding repayment for climate damage is absurd. It would treat loss and damage finance not as a high-interest loan or even as benevolent charity, but as obligatory structural repair.
Exactly.
Okay, we need to transition to the final case study in this section. We are looking at Palestine and Gaza with a specific focus on the period following October 2023. This is arguably the most complex, intensely debated, and heavily scrutinized conflict in the world.
And this is where our role as impartial guides is most critical. We are neutrally delivering Dr. Salili's analytical framework as he applies it to the institutions involved in this conflict. We are not endorsing a political position, but we are going to synthesize his specific argument regarding how legal, medical, and media systems process evidence under extreme stress.
The author is very deliberate in establishing his premises before diving into the analysis. He states explicitly that a life-coherent analysis must absolutely refuse all forms of dehumanization. It must allow the suffering of all civilians to register fully. Right.
He acknowledges the profound reality of Jewish historical trauma, the suffering of Israeli civilians, the unlawfulness of attacks on civilian populations, and the genuine reality of fear. However, he argues that a life-coherent analysis must also resist establishing a false symmetry when the realities of military capacity, territorial control, and structural power are radically unequal.
Building from that premise, his core argument is that this conflict serves as an extreme, tragic demonstration of a massive systemic collapse of global legal, medical, and media systems. He argues this collapse is driven by a dominant geopolitical model that systematically and structurally lowers the precision of Palestinian life evidence.
Let's break down how he maps that collapse, starting with the medical infrastructure. The author specifically cites the case of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, a hospital director in northern Gaza who was detained and allegedly subjected to abuse. How does the theory of generative models explain the targeting of medical professionals? The author uses this to illustrate the terrifying power of a pathological security script. In a healthy, life-coherent international order, a functional hospital or a working doctor serves as the ultimate high-precision alarm.
They are sacred.
Exactly. They are the core infrastructure of life capacity. Harming them is considered crossing an absolute fundamental red line. But the author argues that the dominant security model lowers that precision by absorbing the medical infrastructure into a sprawling security threat script.
How so?
If the dominant model frames the doctor as potentially affiliated with a militant group, or the hospital as potentially concealing a command center, or the ambulance as potentially a transport vehicle for fighters, then the mere suspicion of those things becomes sufficient to collapse all their legal and moral protections.
The living subject, the physician trying to save lives, the premature baby in the incubator, disappears entirely into the administrative object of a security threat. The model defends itself by turning the very instruments of healing into legitimate targets.
Yes.
And the author argues this exact same dynamic of precision lowering happens in the international legal realm. He brings in the International Court of Justice, the ICJ.
Yes. He specifically points to the July 2024 ICJ advisory opinion regarding the unlawfulness of the occupation, as well as the provisional measures issued in the genocide proceedings brought by South Africa. The author maps these events onto the Frestonian biological framework, calling these court rulings legal prediction errors.
I want to clarify that term.
Yeah.
In a biological system, a prediction error is when your internal map doesn't match reality, which should force the system to stop and update its map, right?
Precisely. A life-coherent global system would treat a ruling from the highest court in the world as a massive, high-precision alarm bell. It would demand immediate behavioral correction from the states involved.
But that didn't happen.
But the author argues that the dominant diplomatic and geopolitical model treats these profound legal findings not as reality-altering evidence, but merely as public relations inconveniences to be managed.
They just managed it.
The system attempts to manage the legal texts, diplomatically issuing statements of concern or debating the semantic definitions of the rulings, while ensuring that the underlying material structure on the ground, the flow of weapons and political cover, remains completely intact. The system refuses to let the legal wound update its geopolitical model.
The author also tackles how the media functions within this pathology, referencing an interview by Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Palestinian Territories.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the paper returns to the concept of epistemic communities. Media ecosystems act as organs of collective perception for the public.
But they are the eyes and ears of society.
In this specific case, the author claims that Western legacy media systems often function to amplify the official narratives of the dominant power while structurally casting doubt on Palestinian witnesses and health ministries. The media doesn't have to engage in outright denial or erase the suffering entirely. It simply regulates the precision of the suffering.
How does that work in practice? How do you regulate precision in a news broadcast?
By how you frame causality. A pathological media model frames the image of a dead child, not as a catastrophic failure of a military system or a violation of law, but as a tragic, unavoidable inevitability of urban warfare.
No, it's just framed as collateral damage.
Yes. It frames mass starvation not as a deliberately engineered structure of deprivation, but as a complex, unfortunate humanitarian logistical crisis. And when human rights experts or witnesses like Albanese point directly to the intentional structure behind the harm, the system reflectively attacks the witness.
Enemy production again.
The witness is dangerous because they're raising the precision of the suppressed evidence, demanding that the system feel the reality of what it is supporting.
Which brings us to the author's synthesis of this case study, which is incredibly weighty. He insists on what he calls a life-coherent memory. He writes that Jewish historical trauma is profound, real, and must be respected, but he argues forcefully that a life-coherent system cannot logically or morally use the lesson of one people's profound historical suffering to lower the precision of another people's present suffering.
That is a very powerful point.
He states that true enduring security cannot be defined as the permanent structural insecurity of the other. The overarching diagnosis he offers is that the current model utilizes a security prior, a baseline assumption of threat to transform an entire civilian population into a latent danger while simultaneously disabling the legal, medical, and media systems that are supposed to act as the world's immune response to atrocities.
It is a deeply stark, uncompromising structural analysis. He uses the extreme asymmetry of power in this situation to argue a broader theoretical point. When any system's preferred state of stability requires the ongoing dispossession, containment, or massive suffering of another group of humans, the generative model itself is fundamentally, irrevocably incompatible with life capacity.
Those case studies are heavy. They carry immense historical and human weight. And honestly, it is very easy to read an analysis of global geopolitics and feel completely paralyzed. We are just individuals. We don't control the UN Security Council or the global supply chain of critical minerals.
It can feel very overwhelming.
But the brilliance of Dr. Saley's paper is that it doesn't just diagnose the terminal disease, it actually attempts to provide the medicine. How do we stop these pathological inferential loops? He gives us a practical tool. He calls it a diagnostic grammar. And it is essentially a set of 11 questions you can apply to literally any system you are a part of to test if it is pathologically self-evidencing.
This toolkit is where the paper becomes profoundly actionable. The beauty of these questions is that they scale perfectly. You can apply them to evaluate a nation state's foreign policy, but you can also use them to analyze the dynamics of your family, your local school board, or a corporate reorganization.
I want to highlight a few of these diagnostic questions because they immediately cut through the usual bureaucratic noise. Question one is foundational. What preferred state is the system actually trying to conserve?
Right. Ignore the PR.
Forget the mission statement on the website. Is the system trying to conserve public safety, or is it conserving the chief of Pelosi's political capital? Is the company conserving innovation or just the CEO's bonus structure?
Question four forces us to look at the shadows. Who carries your exported uncertainty? We talked about this with the extraction zones. If a company hits a rough financial patch, how does it regain stability? Does the executive board take a pay cut, or do they instantly lay off 1,000 hourly workers and cut their health benefits?
Someone has to absorb the shock.
Who absorbs the shock so the core can remain comfortable?
Question eight is, I think, the most telling indicator of a toxic culture. How does the system treat the witness?
Oh, this is so important.
When someone inside the system stands up and points out a flaw, a danger, or an ongoing harm, what happens to them? Are they protected, elevated, and listened to? Or are they immediately isolated, discredited, gaslit, and punished? A pathological system always attacks the witness. A life-coherent system protects them.
And question 11 demands brutal honesty. What would the system have to become if the wound were granted full precision? If the system finally stopped deflecting and fully admitted the magnitude of the harm it was causing, what power, what resources, or what comforting illusions would it have to surrender?
Those questions map out the disease. But what does health look like? The author outlines the features of a life-coherent system. The primary feature he emphasizes is corrigibility. I love this word.
It's a great concept.
It is the capacity of an institution or a person to be corrected without collapsing into a defensive rage or outright denial.
A brittle pathological system believes that admitting an error is an existential threat to its authority. It equates being wrong with dying. A mature, corrigible system operates differently. It metabolizes error into transformation. It is able to look at contradictory evidence and say, our generative model was incomplete. Thank you for showing us the wound. Let's redesign the model.
Another key feature is precision reversal. We talked earlier about how power dictates precision. The billionaire's anxiety is loud. The starving child is quiet.
Right.
A life-coherent system deliberately engineers a reversal of that dynamic. It structurally ensures that the pain, the needs, and the testimony of the most vulnerable people affected by the system become the absolute loudest, highest precision alarms in the room.
But you cannot achieve corrigibility or precision reversal without institutionalized humility. Systems must be designed from the ground up with the baseline assumption that they will inevitably cause harm, that they will have blind spots, and that they will be wrong.
Which leads us to the practical architecture. How do you physically build humility into a bureaucracy? The paper concludes with an 18-point blueprint for building self-correcting institutions. We don't have time to cover all 18, but a few of these concepts are paradigm shifting. One major requirement is the absolute necessity of independent correction loops and protected witnessing.
This addresses the fundamental flaw of self-evidencing. You simply cannot trust any institution to objectively audit its own generative model.
It's impossible.
The police cannot investigate themselves. A corporation cannot be the sole judge of its environmental impact. You must construct external ombudspersons, empower citizen oversight assemblies, and provide ironclad, legally impenetrable protection for whistleblowers, journalists, and dissident voices. Dr. Thaley calls these independent actors the social nervous system. If you allow the system to cut off its own nerve endings, the body will inevitably walk itself into a fire.
The concept from the blueprint that absolutely stopped me in my tracks was his distinction between procedural time and lifetime. I've never heard bureaucratic delay articulated so perfectly.
It is a vital, devastating insight. Institutions, by their nature, move on procedural time.
What does that look like?
Procedural time is the time of committees, endless environmental reviews, jurisdictional debates, and phased implementations. An infrastructure review to determine if a pipeline is leaking takes 3 years. A legal appeal for a wrongfully convicted person takes a decade. A diplomatic negotiation regarding humanitarian aid access takes months of geopolitical maneuvering. But human beings do not exist in procedural time. Humans live in biological lifetime. The time of hunger, the time of bleeding, the time of irreversible childhood development.
Exactly. Let's think about a real-world scenario. A chemical plant is leaking toxins into a community's water supply. Procedural time says, we must form an investigative committee, hire outside consultants, gather data for 24 months, draft a preliminary report, and open a 90-day public comment period before we issue a fine.
Sounds very familiar.
But lifetime says, a toddler drinking that water today will suffer permanent, irreversible neurological damage by month 6. The child cannot wait for the committee to finish its procedural dance. Their brain is developing right now. A patient bleeding out in a besieged hospital cannot wait for the UN Security Council to pass a watered-down resolution next Thursday. They need a tourniquet and oxygen today.
The clash between those two timelines is where the most profound violence occurs. Therefore, the author argues, we cannot rely on procedural time when life is on the line. We must architect lifetime triggers into our systems.
Lifetime triggers.
These are hardwired institutional mechanisms that force immediate, material, non-negotiable action the moment biological or ecological thresholds are crossed. You bypass the procedural delays entirely when life capacity is actively being destroyed.
And all of this careful architectural planning leads to what I think is the most profound, resonant takeaway of the entire white paper. It is a phrase that encapsulates the entire mission of the deep dive. The author says we must evolve from a society reliant on heroic witness to a society built on designed corrigibility.
It is a beautiful summation of the human struggle. Think back through history. Think of how many massive social advances or how many exposed atrocities required an individual to completely destroy their own life to get the truth out.
Like ruining their careers, going to jail.
Exactly. It required a whistleblower to face prison, or an investigative journalist to be assassinated, or an entire marginalized community to endure decades of brutal generational trauma before the dominant system finally begrudgingly paid attention. If telling the truth about harm requires a human being to become a martyr, the system is fundamentally, structurally, and morally poorly designed.
We fetishize the heroic whistleblower, but the need for a whistleblower is proof of systemic failure. Ordinary, everyday suffering should be enough to trigger an institutional review. You shouldn't need a perfectly pure, heroic victim willing to sacrifice everything just to get a government agency or a corporation to stop doing harm.
No, you shouldn't.
The system itself should be built with enough humility and sensitivity to gracefully update its model the very moment it senses it has caused a wound.
We cannot rely indefinitely on the sporadic heroism of exhausted individuals. We need architecture. We need systems that listen.
So as we wrap up this incredibly deep journey, I want to turn this directly back to you, the listener. Dr. Saley's paper is vast. We have covered Carl Friston's neuroscience, the horrors of global geopolitics, and the philosophy of biology. But the core mechanism of active inference is intensely, unavoidably personal. Look around your own life this week. Look closely at your family dynamics. Look at the unwritten policies in your workplace, or pay attention to the rhetoric of your local city council. Ask yourself the diagnostic question. What generative model is this system desperately trying to conserve? And more importantly, whose life capacity, whose peace of mind, whose physical health, whose basic dignity is being quietly sacrificed or ignored just to keep that model intact?
And I will leave you with a final provocative thought building entirely on the premise of Dr. Saley's incredible work. We currently live in an era that is obsessively fascinated by artificial intelligence, algorithmic efficiency, and systemic optimization. We have casually accepted a definition of intelligence that equates to the ability to predict, control, dominate, and optimize an environment for maximum output.
Yeah, that's what Silicon Valley sells us.
But if the biological reality of the free energy principle shows us anything, it is that this specific kind of hyper-optimized, boundary-defending intelligence can be perfectly, ruthlessly suicidal if it ignores the biosphere and the messy, fragile living humans that sustain it. A cancer cell is highly optimized. A cancer cell is brilliant at prediction and control. Perhaps true evolutionary intelligence isn't about how perfectly you can defend your borders or how efficiently you can extract resources from your environment. Perhaps true, enduring intelligence is measured simply by how quickly, how willingly, and how gracefully you allow the wound of another to update your model of the world.
That is exactly it. The broken X-ray machine of our institutions can be fixed, but only if we learn to read the signals it has been programmed to ignore. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of denial and the very real blueprint for a life-coherent civilization. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.